We're talking about new recommendations to address homelessness on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The 44-page report is called Welcoming Home Wisconsin, and it lays out the current situation. Upwards of 5,000 residents were experiencing homelessness before the pandemic struck. And this report has strategies to build on the federal pandemic aid that Governor Evers allocated late last year to address housing instability in winter. Do you live with unstable housing? What do you want to convey about your situation? What is it like staying at a shelter, in a car? 800-642-1234 to join in. Michael Bassford is director of the Wisconsin Interagency Council on Homelessness, formed in 2017, bringing together 8 state agencies to prevent and end homelessness in Wisconsin. Michael, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much for having me on again, Kate.
Well, tell us about the people who are experiencing homelessness in Wisconsin. Bring us closer to this problem that we get a lens in through this report.
Sure. So prior to the pandemic, we were operating under what I would call a normal state of crisis. On any given night in the state of Wisconsin, there were usually about 4,500 people that were experiencing homelessness throughout the state. And so that was very concerning. The pandemic caused an increase in instability, in housing instability, and caused an increase in homelessness, particularly unsheltered homelessness, and that would be people experiencing homelessness who are sleeping outside. And that created a number of encampments in cities that had unsheltered homelessness before, and increased the number of municipalities throughout the state where they were experiencing having people sleeping outside. So the plan that we released this week was specifically designed to be a post-pandemic plan. A lot of the action items that are on there, keep in mind that we are still operating under taking care of a exacerbated need for people experiencing homelessness and housing insecurity.
Before we move on to points in the plan, just curious, the point in time count, that night count of sheltered and unsheltered people experiencing homelessness on a single night, usually in January, how has it been to carry out that count, especially this year in the Omicron variant? Did it go? And are you confident about getting an accurate count of homelessness in the pandemic?
Well, last year, when the point in time count was done, that was done before a widespread availability of vaccines. Mm-hmm. And the point in time count relies on a lot of community volunteering in order for it to be pulled off successfully. So there were quite a fewer number of volunteers last year. And as a result, the numbers looked like that we had fewer people that were experiencing homelessness in Wisconsin. But the fact of the matter was is that it was just an undercount. I haven't heard the final numbers yet, and we won't hear the final numbers from the January point in time count for another few months, as coalitions all around the state are compiling their data. So we don't exactly know yet what the Omicron surge and its effects were on the point in time count.
Let's move on to housing. Your council says the single greatest barrier is affordable housing. And we talked with Madison Mayor Satya Rhodes Conway this week about housing in Madison. Let's just take a listen here.
As it is for many others, we know that right now to have a healthy vacancy rate in our rental market, we need approximately 4,000 units of new housing just today.
approximately 4,000 units of new housing just today. What does that tell you?
Well, that tells me, well, first of all, Mayor Rhodes Conway is absolutely right. She definitely understands the need for more housing. But what is more troubling for me is not only the lack of housing, but the lack of availability for housing that is affordable for people who are at low income and extremely low income. These are people who are, their income is 50% or less than an area's median income.
And I think you should, if you could, explain the terminology, the difference between market rate housing and affordable housing.
Well, market rate housing is considered to be whatever the market in an area will allow for landlords to rent units out at.
Mm-hmm.
HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, has an affordability standard for housing where people, it's affordable if for the person or the household that they are not spending more than 30% of their income on their housing costs. The National Low Income Housing Coalition estimates that the state of Wisconsin is currently short about 119,000 units for low and extremely low income households. So that means not only is it the main barrier for homeless people, people experiencing homelessness to get out of homelessness and into housing, but also for people who are in housing, who are at low and extremely low incomes, that they are spending quite a bit more of their monthly income for their housing costs, and that makes households housing insecure. I mean, you are a COVID diagnosis or a broken arm away from missing shifts and not being able to rent.
We're talking with Michael Basford, director of the Wisconsin Interagency Council on Homelessness. Council released a report this week with recommendations on how to end homelessness. You can join in. Do you live with unstable housing? What do you want to convey? Have you seen programs or solutions to homelessness in other states or countries? 800-642-1234. So, Michael, what is some of the first steps forward to be able to create more affordable housing?
Well, we've been very fortunate that the federal government has invested a significant amount of money to assist people who are renting, who for whatever reason during the economic downturn were not able to pay rent. And so there's emergency rental assistance available for them. There have been programs out there, investments, particularly HUD's home funds, which can be used for the development of affordable housing. Last year, Governor Evers announced a neighborhood investment fund program of $200 million that communities have been applying for, and he has been, over the last few days, visiting communities and announcing awards for their applications. And a lot of these projects will be adding affordable housing units to the market. So that is all from the federal investment from the CARES Act, from ARPA.
And it sounds like it's in the pipeline.
So it's in the pipeline, exactly.
Michael Basford directs the Wisconsin Interagency Council on Homelessness, which is out with its statewide action plan. Are you a landlord? What is it like managing unstable rent payments? What has helped your tenants stay housed? Have you seen programs or solutions elsewhere that you want Wisconsin to adopt? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Michael Basford here on the Ideas Network. Housing is a human right. It is a guiding principle of the Wisconsin Interagency Council on Homelessness. And those words are in bold print in their new statewide action plan that we're talking about on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The report says over the past dozen years, programs administered by the state have seen cuts and flat funding for services that house people experiencing homelessness. Are you worried about losing your home? Where could you turn to for immediate help? Do you work for an organization that serves homeless clients? What do you want to bring up? 800-642-1234. Michael Bassford directs the state's Interagency Council on Homelessness with us for about 9 more minutes. Michael, the number of veterans experiencing homelessness in Wisconsin was nearly cut in half in the past decade. What are the bright spots there that are working with this segment of the population?
So that is the result of a very great program that was launched by the federal government in 2009. Then VA Director General Shinseki and HUD Secretary Sean Donovan both announced a plan to a 5-year plan to what they called to end veteran homelessness in America. Mm-hmm. Now, they weren't able to do that. They were able to by the end of the Obama administration, they were able to effectively cut in half the number of veterans experiencing homelessness throughout the country. And that was excellent. That's tens of thousands of people who have served our country who now are in homes rather than experiencing homelessness. Now that's the good news. It was through the program that they had was called HUDVASH, where HUD provided housing vouchers and the VA provided supportive services to allow the veterans to maintain housing stability once they got into housing. However, not every veteran qualifies for this program, including veterans who have served our country in combat. And as a result, it's estimated in the state of Wisconsin on any given night, we have about 350 homeless veterans. And so we still need to put in some extra efforts, some additional investment so that we can get those numbers housed and end veteran homelessness as we know it in the state. And I think that we can do that.
And can we do that? Is it the issue with funding for these programs? Because the legislature has largely refused to make new financial commitments for homelessness. And in May, we saw Republicans reject Governor Evers' plan to provide around $70 million for initiatives. So what is it that you need to be able to carry out these programs?
We need the legislature to understand a few things. Understand first and foremost that we can that we can, with proper investment, end homelessness. That more and what should stand out is that it's actually cheaper to house people than it is to have them maintain homelessness. So, you know, if we could get people housed, we can get all sorts of positive community outcomes, from better test scores in schools to lower crime rates to a better workforce for employers, for better physical and mental health outcomes.
And you have this really interesting statistics that it costs a community $30,000 to $50,000 for each person who is experiencing chronic homelessness.
Correct.
That's a significant amount of money.
Yeah, and that all comes from things such as police contacts, emergency detentions, having to go to the emergency room for physical health conditions, because homelessness is bad for your health. Mm-hmm. Let's make no mistake about that. all of these costs have to be borne by the communities. And when you consider that housing costs can only be a fraction of that, that's where you get the idea that if you want to save money for communities, invest in that housing, invest in these wraparound programs, get people housed, and get them stable.
Talking about ways to end homelessness in Wisconsin with the head of the Wisconsin Interagency Council on Homelessness, Michael Bassford, is here. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Bob is joining us from Richland Center with a perspective. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. So I am a landlord, and we do try to work with HUD. One of the challenges we have is we could rent our units out for more than what HUD reimburses, but we want to try and provide some housing and make that work. The challenge we then have is we want to do the good upgrades. We want to put insulated windows in and insulate the ceiling and do more of that, but the income is less, so we have to space that out. Are there any programs that help that so we can keep helping the project, but also can maintain and improve the efficiency? I know We Energies does a program. Is there anything else out there that helps with that?
Bob, thank you. And I know it was difficult to hear Bob saying being a landlord, trying to make those upgrades when the amount of rent that you're getting in, you're slower and able to make those upgrades to the housing. Any programs that you can point him to, Michael?
Well, I can't point him to any other programs that are in existence right now, but one of the action items in the plan has been to call for a fund of $2 million a year for landlords throughout the state, because we absolutely understand and take on board how important it is to have landlords and have landlords be comfortable in housing people who have been experiencing homelessness. And what that program does is that program would provide small grants to landlords to get their units up to housing quality standards. And it would also provide a little bit of insurance should there be necessary repairs to have to be done as a result of damage done by people who they've rented to. So that, of course, is an action item. It's going to require the state legislature to approve it, to approve the program and to approve the funding. But it's something that this administration absolutely supports.
And it was interesting what Bob said there is, you know, I want to help, but I can also make more rent by just renting out market rate and not, you know, bothering, if you will, with the HUD program of reimbursement.
Yeah, I certainly appreciate that sentiment. And we're going to need to find ways to get more landlords like Bob in a good position to be able to rent out their places. And just about every landlord that I talk with is just like Bob. They do want to help. And you know, renting out at affordable units, you know, comes with a slight amount of risk, and we want to make sure that risk is mitigated. But we are certainly going to, of course, going forward, be looking at other initiatives that we may be able to do to get more landlords like Bob in the business of renting out units to help people, because I take him at his word when he says he wants to help people, and I certainly understand that.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure thing. Thank you for having me, and and have a good day.
You too. Michael Bassford, director of the Wisconsin Interagency Council on Homelessness. We have a link to the council's report called Welcoming Wisconsin Home. It's at WPR.org/mornings. Ahead this hour, we talk with a law professor about Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson's nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court and why diversity in our nation's high court matters. How do you feel about her path to confirmation? Can you think of other influential women judges whom you want to talk about? 800-642-1234. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about language.
The United States is a nation of immigrants, and the pressure to assimilate can be great. Some people are compelled to speak English and leave other languages behind. Here's contributor Eric Dregney with a look back at his own family's relationship with language.
Those traitorous Scandinavian languages. Don't be suspected. My grandparents spoke a mix of Norwegian and Swedish, or Svorsk, as it was known. They used it mostly when they wanted an unintelligible language to keep secrets from the grandkids. How I wish they'd passed on this language to me. Being second-generation Scandinavians, they wanted to keep their distance from their immigrant parents and their thick accents and their old-world ways. I used to believe this. I thought that the old language fell into disuse and immigrants wanted to learn English. This perpetuated half-truth doesn't tell the tale of government agents spying on Scandinavian and German meetings looking for socialists or anti-war activists. Settlers spoke English as a matter of self-preservation, and any dissension was deemed unpatriotic. My grandfather told me he could only speak Norwegian when he entered kindergarten, and then would get in trouble since he didn't know English. How could he? I begged my grandfather to teach me Norwegian, but he warned me. We're in America. We speak English. It's better that way. Clearly, he was scared of something I didn't understand. Then I discovered that some state governments set up a Commission of Public Safety during World War I. Its purpose, to root out those deemed untrustworthy. It was mostly Germans, and Scandinavians by default, those with mixed loyalty who could be considered traitors. These commissions employed virtually dictatorial powers to distribute pro-war propaganda and to restrict activities it considered hostile. These government agents infiltrated meetings and rallies to make lists of radicals and slackers, as well as just plain foreigners who lacked enthusiasm to go to war. Because it was wartime, those who questioned could be locked up indefinitely. These commissions posted notices that read, "Don't be suspected. Use American language. America is our home." This is why my grandfather was afraid. But apparently, the story was not unique. A young Swedish boy in Ashland, Wisconsin, during World War I said, "We never speak Swedish on the street. Olaf was roughed up by some of the Yankee boys in a restaurant last week." Because Scandinavian languages are somewhat similar to German, anyone caught speaking them was viewed as having foreign sympathies and possibly a spy for Kaiser Wilhelm. Of course, it didn't help that the pro-Hitler German-American Bund set up Camp Hindenburg in Grafton, Wisconsin in the 1930s to help young German kids become good Nazis. Up until the World Wars, immigrants often had little incentive to learn English, since most daily business transactions happened in their native language. Jim Jensen, a TV newscaster from Kenosha, said, "If you went to the Danish Brotherhood, you spoke Danish. At church, the services, the sermon, my confirmation ceremony, all in Danish." Churches and social organizations tried to retain their language, although they were on the lookout for infiltrators. Many would begin conversations in English and then slip into their native tongue once they felt safe. Many churches switched services to English to show loyalty to the U.S., but mostly to avoid suspicion. One Lutheran parishioner joked, I have nothing against the English language. I use it myself every day. But if we don't teach our children Norwegian, what will they do when they get to heaven?
Eric Dregney teaches English at Concordia University in St. Paul. He's the author of several books, including Vikings in the Attic, In Search of Nordic America. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
And now to President Biden's nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court. Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson started courtesy meetings with senators this week ahead of her confirmation hearings that get underway in a little over 2 weeks. We're exploring women judges over the decades who have been in the running, shortlisted for nomination, but ultimately got passed over, and how their stories inform the present day. Do you think diversity should be considered when judges are appointed to the Supreme Court? It's 800-642-1234. Renee Kanaki Jefferson is a law professor at the University of Houston, co-authored the book Shortlisted, published in 2020. Renee, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Judge Jackson, first Black woman to be nominated to the High Court, which was made up entirely of white men for almost two centuries. What do you make of this moment?
Well, it's historic for many reasons. It's a long time coming. Women, Black women, have been on president's shortlists for over 40 years. And for the entire time, women were allowed to join the Supreme Court. That, of course, was in 1981, when Sandra Day O'Connor became the first female justice on the court. With this nomination, the Supreme Court takes another step forward in better reflecting the public that it serves, in that we will now see a Black woman on the High Court. But Judge Jackson brings far more diversity than simply her race and her gender. She also will be the only justice on the Supreme Court who has served as a federal public defender. And that's important because our public defenders are the lawyers who represent individuals faced with criminal charges who can't afford an attorney. And so she'll be bringing a very different perspective based on work that she did before she became a judge. And then I'll also just note, her nomination is quite extraordinary because she has such deep experience. She's been a judge for many years, and as I said, had a range of experiences as a lawyer prior to coming to the bench, not just being a public defender, but also serving on the U.S. Sentencing Commission and in other capacities. So it's an incredible moment. It's hopefully a moment to set aside partisanship and really celebrate in the life of this country.
It's interesting, your perspective, too, and what you bring to light. And it aligns what I think what the press has been talking about with this judge. But it was really interesting to me because you study how the media portray these nominees. And, you know, even going back to the 1950s with the California Appeals Court Judge Mildred Lilly in the shortlisted in the Nixon years. What is significant about the treatment of these potential nominees and how they get shown in the press?
Well, let's talk about Judge Lilly for just a second. So part of what inspired the what's now our book, Shortlisted: Women in the Shadows of the Supreme Court, was an article that we found. It was actually written in 1971. It was published in the New York Times, and it listed Richard Nixon's shortlist. He was the first president to allow his shortlist to go public, if you will. And on that list were two names that were women and four men. The two women were Sylvia Bacon, a judge in Washington, D.C., and Mildred Lilly, as you note, a judge from California. In addition to listing her extensive qualities that made her qualified to sit on the Supreme Court, the article noted that she maintained her bathing beauty figure even in her 50s and fortunately had no children. Needless to say, none of the men in that article had any reference to how they looked in their swim trunks. And of course, that reflected the really explicit overt sexism of that era where, you know, thinking back to the late 60s and early 70s, women were regularly still excluded from professional life and from the workplace. You would think now in 2022 that this kind of gendered coverage has changed. And I'm ever optimistic, but I will tell you that so far things are not looking like they will have improved very much for Judge Jackson. She is already getting scrutiny that we have not seen male nominees get for the court. I've studied this. I've looked at every article written by the New York Times and the Washington Post going back to the early 70s through the nominations of actually Judges Kagan and Sotomayor. And what that study showed is that women are more likely to be scrutinized for qualities that have nothing to do with being a Supreme Court justice, whether it's their appearance or their marital status. And the headline that I think is getting a lot of buzz right now is a recent reporter was focusing on Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson's LSAT score. That, of course, is the test you have to take to get into law school. It would sort of like be, you know, asking how's she performing on her Wordle puzzles? It's a really sort of silly inquiry. I guarantee you, if President Biden had selected a white man, no one would be asking his LSAT score. And so I think we're going to see coverage continue that has nothing to do with the nominee's qualifications to sit on the court.
Something that I hadn't thought about that you raise in your book is how the testimony that comes from the American Bar Association, and how one of your women in history who got an unqualified ranking from the American Bar Association, who was totally qualified, but how much does the ABA factor in here?
Well, the ABA used to have a pretty significant role in vetting nominees to the court. That started in the Eisenhower era. He was not a lawyer or a judge himself and reached out to the American Bar Association to assist in vetting judges. But there really was a change in the ABA's role after Reagan, in part because, as you note, in those years, so the judge in particular that the ABA ranked and qualified was Mildred Lilly, who we were just talking about, a judge from California. She was completely qualified to be on the Supreme Court. In fact, in a later interview, Nixon, of course, was the president who was considering her, and his White House counsel, John Dean, in a later interview said he looked at Lilly's resume next to that of Sandra Day O'Connor, and she was equally, if not more qualified than O'Connor to join the court. And so the American Bar Association at that time was really known for deliberately ranking women and minorities as unqualified or less qualified as a way to exclude them from ascending onto the court. Now, fast forward to today, I anticipate that the ABA will rank Judge Jackson well qualified. She'll get their highest qualification. The role of the American Bar Association now is no longer one to vet who comes off the shortlist, but instead to sort of provide advice once we know who the nominee is. So it's a different function. And also the American Bar Association has really evolved from being an organization that was prohibiting diversity to one that is really championing it now.
And notably too, the ABA gives remarks on the final day of her confirmation hearings.
Yes. And so again, because she has been repeatedly confirmed already by the Senate and gone through the ABA review process, I think we will have no surprises here. Uh-huh. And in fact, that's probably part of why President Biden has selected her. He had a long list of extraordinarily qualified Black women to put on the court. One thing that does set Judge Jackson apart is the fact that she has been confirmed repeatedly by the Senate, and in fact, by this very same Senate just last year when she was elevated to her seat on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. She received bipartisan support, which is pretty extraordinary in this era of such partisanship. Yeah, so I anticipate, although she will probably go through quite grueling hearings and a lot of unpleasant scrutiny, that she will be confirmed.
University of Houston law professor Renee Kanaki Jefferson is an expert on professional responsibility, legal ethics, studies the media's portrayal of nominees to the U.S. Supreme Court. What have you learned so far about Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson's legal pedigree? What do you notice about the way she is portrayed and talked about in the press? Do you think that a judge's background affects how they rule on cases? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. Judge Amy Coney Barrett became the fifth woman seated on the U.S. Supreme Court in 2020. Overall, 115 justices have served on the high court. Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, if confirmed, would be the first Black woman, as we've talked about, to ever serve on our nation's highest court. As we look at SCOTUS gender history, how it informs today on The Morning Show, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Pew Research Center pointed out recently Black women account for a small fraction of the federal judges who have served to date. What do women bring to the bench? Who is your favorite woman justice through time and why? 800-642-1234. University of Houston law professor Renee Kanaki Jefferson stays with us. Renee, some Republicans have criticized the idea that race or gender should be a qualifying factor for SCOTUS. What do you make of these complaints?
Well, I find them to be completely disingenuous. They fly in the face of history and past practice of presidents on both from both parties. In this instance, it's not at all unusual for President Biden to have narrowed his search for a nominee to a particular demographic. And it's not to say that she's qualified because she's a Black woman. She happens to be exceptionally well qualified in addition to also being a Black woman. And in fact, there were many that could have been selected because Black women have long been qualified to sit on the court and in fact were shortlisted all the way back to the 1980s when President Reagan put his first shortlist together to put a woman on the court. By the way, just as Biden did, Reagan campaigned on a promise to put a woman on the court and make his first nominee to the Supreme Court female, which in fact he did. On that shortlist, of course, was Sandra Day O'Connor. She came off to become our first female justice. But also Amalia Kearse, a judge who is a Black woman and sits to this day in senior status on the Second Circuit Federal Court of Appeals. And even in more recent history, we have an example of a president narrowing his search when Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away. President Trump, in short order, promised he would put a woman on the court to replace her. But I think his exact quote was, "I like women better than men." Presidents for a long time have narrowed their search to certain demographics, not just women either, I should point out, but in the past have focused on geography, wanting to have a more diverse bench in terms of where the justices had grown up, where they had come from. And religion also has been a demographic that some presidents have looked at. So the idea that President Biden is doing anything unusual here, or that somehow the only way Judge Jackson has made it to this moment is because of her race or because she is a woman, is just silly.
I thought it was interesting, too. You bring up during the Truman, Harry Truman administration, a candidate who was shot down because the Chief Justice thought it would get in the way of how men deliberate with their shoes off and their shirt collars open. And, you know, and it's not just that sentiment that this is, you know, a man's only type club, but just that the Chief Justice could have that much bearing on who that nominee would be.
Well, when we think about the early women who literally threw the courthouse doors open, they had very explicit barriers to their presence, both in terms of the way their male counterparts felt about the idea of presiding over cases with a woman. And it's Florence Allen, by the way, who was considered by presidents, I'm going back to, yes, Truman, Hoover, and FDR. She was the first female on the Ohio Supreme Court, and then the first female judge on the Sixth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals. FDR put her there in 1934. And when she joined the court, there wasn't even a bathroom for her to use in chambers. I mean, this is, you know, literally a workplace that was not prepared for women. And in my study, there were 9 women who were officially shortlisted by presidents before O'Connor joined the court. And in learning about what they had to endure, not only did they have to be at the top of their class in law school, but when they left trying to find a job, they were often told, we can't hire you because we don't have appropriate facilities here for women. In other words, they didn't have bathrooms or a place where they felt that women would be, you know, allowed in professional life. Now, of course, women no longer face such explicit barriers, but the fact that we have had women on the Supreme Court for 40 years, and now only now are we seeing a Black woman join the court, I think is proof that barriers do remain, and they are even higher for minority women.
Renee Kanaki Jefferson, law professor, University of Houston, a researcher, author at the intersection of gender, power, law, and leadership. You can join in with your thoughts on the nomination, 800-642-1234. Judge Susie Sharp said, you know, oft a bridesmaid, never a bride. It seems as if, you know, some of these nominees, they've been shortlisted multiple times.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And in fact, a good example of that, and one that I think is really relevant in terms of how we are at this moment and seeing our first Black female justice join the court, is to go back to Amalia Kearse. So again, she was first shortlisted in 1981 by President Reagan when he selected O'Connor. Now, Reagan had more than one vacancy on the Supreme Court. He could have given us our second woman or our third woman on the court, but he didn't. One was enough for him. Judge Kearse, though, was shortlisted again by him for the seat that ultimately went to Justice Kennedy. Then when George H.W. Bush was facing concerns surrounding his nomination of Clarence Thomas, Kearse's name surfaced again as a possible solution if Thomas's confirmation had failed, which of course it didn't. And then most recently, Kearse was shortlisted yet again by President Clinton for the very seat, Justice Breyer's seat, that will now finally go to a Black woman.
In our few moments left, how would you think Judge Jackson would fit into a court environment that leans 6-3 in favor of conservatives?
Well, she will certainly be part of the three, right? And I think she's going to have a really important role here. Even though it's true, the ideological shift will remain 6-3. The three women judges, or just justices, will often be acting in dissent. And what they write and how they write it matters. It matters because we know that dissents can pave the way for a change in jurisprudence in the future to eventually become the majority opinion. It matters because dissents can rally the people to action, to perhaps go to the legislature to make a change. And she will offer an important counterpoint. For the first time ever, the nation is going to see four women sitting on the Supreme Court. They are diverse on many levels. And that's important as symbolically for the nation, not just to see at that high level, but thinking about women in professional life in general. Being able to see them remove stereotypes of what women can and should do, and allows for so much more possibility. And she, of course, will be bringing that to her role as well.
Renee Kanaki Jefferson on the Ideas Network.